This is the lecture for Biochem 421 for November 6, 2009.
All right. Well, we're now dealing with chapter 14, first little part of chapter 14. This is November 6th, I believe. Is that correct? Yes, November 6th. And we're basically just starting into part of 14. And we had finished, we were looking at section 14.2, and that is, what causes the increase in the rate of reaction. And we were looking at entropy loss, destabilization of the enzyme substrate complex. And these top two are really connected to this bottom line where it says proximity and orientation. Those three really are a set of concepts that can apply to all enzyme mechanisms. Then we have three specific ones: covalent, general acid-base catalysis, and metal ion catalysis. We might look on in detail. But we're going to take a look at the first two and the last one in detail initially. Now, again, whenever you have an enzyme, the enzyme and the substrate must bind. I don't want to get too close to that computer again. Maybe I come down. Yeah, move it out of the way. Absolutely. Casey, would you mind shaking hands with me? All right, so we have a good tight binding situation here. Is that correct?
Sure.
Oh, by no means. Again, Max Jardine could break your hand. He has genetically, he's like a $60 million man. So we have a good strong handshake right here. Can a handshake be too strong? Yeah, it can be. It could literally hurt that. But that's not the situation you find in enzymes. What you could have is that enzyme substrate binds so strongly that it then never releases. Okay. So there's a compromise. It can't be so loose that it never really changes anything. I mean, have you ever shaken a hand with somebody? Hi. Especially if it's wet and clammy. Is this cold? No, never mind. Anyway, it's a good... Hi. Yeah. Anyway, so you can't have it too loose because then there would not be any change in the conformation or movement of the substrate to the transition state shape. What did I just say? It can't be so loose that it doesn't change the conformation of the substrate to the transition state, but neither can it be so strong as it never releases. Right? So there is a compromise that apparently, according to modern theory, has taken billions and billions of years to create. Or it could have been designed by a genius. You figure it out. All right. Binding must be favorable, but of course it what? Not too favorable. Oh, it's like... what is the fairy tale? You know, the porridge is not too hot and not too cold. What is it? Goldilocks. Yeah. Well, every enzyme is always Goldilocks because the binding is just right. Not too loose, but not too tight. Goal is to make the energy barrier between ES and the EX, that's a transition state, small. So you can see here the binding is favorable, but if it's too favorable and that goes down too far, the binding's too tight, then you can't get up the hill to make the transition state. So here's no destabilization and no catalyst. That is where the binding, the enzyme substrate, is so large. The energy difference between the enzyme substrate and the transition state is so large, you might as well not even catalyze it. And here you have another situation where this is figure 14.3 in the current handout, where you've got the enzyme product is bound tightly. Well, how good is that? That's no good either. You don't want it so tight that it never releases. So what happens is there are factors that enable that initial binding to be resisted to some degree. Compromise between binding and not binding. And therefore, the difference is there is a drop, a stabilization of the enzyme substrate, but it's not so stable that the energy barrier going up to the EX transition state is so large as to be insurmountable. And then the EP, of course, is also a dip in the... It is also fairly stable, but not so stable as to be unreleasable. All right. So what role does entropy loss and destabilization of the ES complex play? raising the energy of the enzyme substrate raises the rate. In other words, okay, what this next slide is saying, if we're looking at the previous slide, they're saying on the right hand or left hand figure or the A figure under 14.3, you see there where the enzyme substrate is very, very stable, very low in a very deep valley. They're saying we have at least two methods, two ideas that keep that from being so stable. So reduce the depth of that dip. And here they are, and going back to the next slide, this is accomplished by entropy loss due to the formation of ES and destabilization of ES by strain, distortion, and desolvation. Strain, distortion, and desolvation. I'm not exactly sure what the difference between strain and distortion is, but they show it there. Maybe we'll figure it out. All right. So, the first thing here that they talk about is A. The next slide talks about A, the loss of entropy formation and loss of entropy due to formation of ES. All right. And what that really means is substrate and enzyme are free to undergo translational motion, a disordered high entropy situation. So if I was going to come up and talk with Casey again, okay, you move your computer out of the way, please. I'll stand like this. So here is, in three dimensions, a substrate. Okay, would you mind being the enzyme in three dimensions? What are you? Are you attached to some sort of immobile structure? No. I mean this. I want your movement in three dimensions. 1, 2, 3. Anyway, okay. So here we are. I'm an enzyme substrate. I'm a substrate, and he's an enzyme. Okay. I know it looks ridiculous, but this is actually what's happening in the molecular structure. Isn't it right? Am I wrong? Is this substrate I'm moving like this? Please don't be too humiliated. Okay, right. So I'm moving like this because I'm in a chaotic three-dimensional Brownian movement situation. I'm in solution, am I not? It's not a joke. So is the enzyme. Please do it. All right? Okay, now what happens when we bind? Now, we're all moving together still, but has the enzyme and substrate lost degrees of freedom when they bound? Have they become more ordered when they bind? Have they become more ordered when they bind? Say yes. Yes. Okay. So is that a favorable or unfavorable situation according to thermodynamics? Unfavorable. Highly ordered, low entropy complex. That reduces this dip in figure 14.3. All right. The next thing is solvation shell. Many times there's water associated. Again, so I can't show water, but I mean, I don't know. Yeah, this is not all that bad of a water molecule. But anyway, the water molecule is associated with a solvate because it's solvated. But when it associates with the enzyme, that water is stripped off. So the solvation shell is removed as the substrate enters into the enzyme. That costs energy. That, again, raises the ES. And also raises the EP as well, because you're going just the opposite. And finally, electrostatic destabilization of substrate, just like charges an active site, charge repulsion was leading the course of reaction, electrostatic. Okay, so what happens here is, one other theory is that electrostatic destabilization, in other words, if we talked about geometric specificity, but sometimes it doesn't work right, and so you got a pen here, and I got a pen here, and we try to meet, and there's a repulsion there due to the two things being there. So there can sometimes be an electrostatic destabilization that negative charges actually destabilize the transition state. And next is the following. So let's go back. Here we go. Loss of entropy, formation of ES, strain, distortion, desolvation. So these two actually, I don't think we've talked it out necessarily, but it's related to this thing right here. And at any rate, okay, so I just want to make sure what I've got going on here. So let's review. We're talking about loss of entropy due to formation of ES, which is this thing and this thing. Then we had strain, distortion, desolvation, which were these things and this thing. All right. So those are all reasons why the enzyme substrate complex is not so low, not so stable as to prevent its transition state formation. Now, I want to go back to this point right here. Notice entropy loss of enzyme substrate formation. We talked about that. Destabilization of ES. We talked about that with the strain and the electrostatic business. Then the proximity and orientation effects is what we're talking about next. Now, proximity and orientation effects are reason for a... this is not a hindering of the process. This actually is why one reason why a catalyst accelerates. I'm looking at figure 14.15 in our current handout, and this is called example of proximity effects in catalysis. This graph demonstrates why an enzyme speeds up a chemical reaction. This speeds up a chemical reaction. Now, the first line, A, has the production of, what is this? At any rate, this is a, what's going on here? We got the nitrogen here, the hydrogen plus this, is that. All right, what happens here is, it appears like this material right here is an important catalytic part of breaking apart this ester. Notice you got an ester linkage right there, and afterwards you have the alcohol and the acid. So this histidine-like side chain is important for the catalytic effect here. Notice this is now a separate molecule, independent of this particular catalytic site, and the rate is fairly low, 35 molar per minute. But notice what they've done in level in B. They have actually physically attached the catalytic intermediate, as it were, to the ester linkage. They physically brought it closer together because this is free in solution and now this is attached to the material. And the rate is increased dramatically. Okay, so that's a proximity effect. You get the catalytic site, you get the catalytic activity positioned in the ideal location for the substrate to be acted upon by it. Proximity effects. Another way is orientation effects. That is, you get the active site precisely in the right orientation for it to occur. All right, let's see here. Let's take a look at this. What are we making between this alcohol and ester? What are we making here? We go from... do you have this overhead? Yeah. You have... this is the figure 14.16 in your handout. It's called orientation effects and intramolecular reactions can be dramatic. So here you have a situation where you've got this carboxylic acid and the alcohol. They're pretty close. That would be a proximity effect. They're pretty close. But notice... though that bond right there and that bond right there are freely rotatable. So this carboxylic acid is rotating like a helicopter blade. Foom, 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 foom. Just like that around here because it can. It's just vroom, it rip, like that. So what happens is then you can make a cyclic ester. What's a cyclic ester called? What is it? Lactone. What's a cyclic amide called? Lactam. Exactly. All right, so they get a particular rate constant here. 5.9 times 10 minus 6. So it's fairly slow. They then put all these bulky groups in here that make it stable such that the carboxylic acid and the alcohol are on top of each other. In other words, they have this thing still whipping around, kind of, except with all these methyl groups sitting there, it's almost, its lowest energy position is right there on top of each other. You've oriented the two substrates necessary for the reaction to occur in the proper position. And suddenly the reaction rate goes up to 1.5 times 10 to the 6th, and the ratio is 10 to the 11th times faster when you position one reactant on top of the other. Am I making sense here? Is this making sense? This is called the orientation effect. This simply puts everything close together, which is the what? Proximity. And that's related to... that's related to this proximity and orientation. Okay? Are we making that connection? Alrighty then. How do transition state analogs bind tightly to the active site? Transition state analogs bind to the active... they do that by binding very tightly to the active site. All right? This affinity can be as much as 10 to the 15th molar. Okay? Transition state analogs, TSAs, and that's not the Transportation Safety Administration. Transition state analogs do pretty well. Proline racemase was the first reaction. So what they do is proline racemase, a racemase changed L-proline to D-proline, had this transition state. Notice it was a flat transition state, essentially. What they've done here is they've made two compounds that have that mimic that transition state. Okay? They mimic that transition state. And what happens is, then, when they mimic that transition state, they bind so tightly that it holds up the rest of the reaction. All right, so, if I may borrow again, Mr. Casey. You don't mind, do you, Mr. Casey? Of course not. All right, so we're going to shake hands, and then we're going to make the product. Of course, I come in here relatively flat. The transition state is like this, and I get something that looks like this as the transition state. Now, if I made a chemical... let's say this enzyme was responsible for high blood pressure. Okay? If I could knock this enzyme out, I could lower the blood pressure of your patient. Okay? Now, if I could find a chemical that matched the transition state perfectly, I would come in here, bind this, and since it matches the transition state perfectly but does not react, what did I just say? Binds the transition state but does what? Not react. Guess what happens? I never let go because the binding constant is so strong. Now, can that enzyme now cause high blood pressure? No, because it's occupied by this drug that's the transition state analog, binds it, doesn't let it go. Eventually, the cell goes, what are you doing here? And it destroys the enzyme. The compound is released, metabolized, and you have low blood pressure and you take a pill for it. Okay? Many, many pills, many, many drugs are what? What did I just say? Many of them are what? Transition state analogs. If you have an enzyme that's causing a disease condition and you want to knock it out, invariably you find the structure of the transition state, you make a compound that's readily tolerable but has the structure of the transition state, and bingo, you have a drug. Now, tell me something about aspartame. What is it about aspartame? Okay. Aspartame has the transition slightly, but not completely, very similar to the perfect transitions, perfect binding structure for the sweet sensor on your tongue. Okay? Aspartame. Okay. Okay. I'll just shake Mr. Master's hand. Okay? So, he's a sweet sensor. I'm sucrose. How you doing? Yes, indeed. Okay. Did you sense the sweetness? Okay. I'm aspartame. Okay. Now I'm aspartame. I come in here. Now, how sweet am I? Oh, hey. If I bind really swell and stimulate you a lot, am I very sweet or not very sweet?
Very sweet.
Very sweet. So, do I need as many molecules to gain the same sweetness as with sugar? No. So rather than having 100 bazillion molecules in your mouth to cause that sweetness sensation, I only have 100 million of aspartame. And when I go try to calculate the caloric count of aspartame, there's so little of it required to make a sweet sensation in your mouth, it's essentially a diet drink. It's not that aspartame doesn't have any calories. It's just it has such a sweet, intense binding to the sweet sensor. You need so few of it to get the same sensation. All right. Again, the idea of a catalytic mechanism. All right. So, let's go ahead. Not catalytic mechanism, but idea of a transition state analog that stimulates or binds tightly. What are catalytic mechanisms of catalysis? Covalent catalysis, serine proteases. This serine protease, I want you to be, you need to read the chapter and you need to understand thoroughly the current model of serine protease that you see there, similar to this. So serine proteases, I'm going to hit pretty hard. They are a model for how enzyme catalysis occurs in a covalent sense. In a covalent catalysis, the enzyme substrate become linked in a covalent bond at one or more points in the reaction pathway. So the enzyme and substrate literally become covalently linked in a covalent catalysis. Since that provides a new pathway, and apparently at a lower energy of activation, it acts as a catalyst. Okay, so let's see here. What am I concerned about? What typically you're going to find here is this middle one. This middle one right here is one that's very similar to the serine protease. Here you've got a nucleophile that attacks backside a carbonyl group that creates a tetrahedral structure, and you end up having this acyl enzyme structure that permanently binds the substrate to the enzyme. That's broken eventually in the process. But nevertheless, that indicates it was covalently bound at one time, and therefore it's a covalent catalysis. Here you've got a situation, and this is a cysteine kind of catalysis, in which you've got a cysteine. And notice why do I know it's a cysteine? How do I know it's a cysteine? It's got a sulfur group. That's correct. Free sulfur group. Tax that carbonyl backside, you get this tetrahedral intermediate. But there's a base here that comes in and extracts out that hydrogen to get that intermediate. And then eventually, how do they have this come in? They had some other, had an acid come in and break that. But it says here, falling hydride to transfer to NAD plus nucleophile attack by phosphate yields the product again. So the phosphate comes in and breaks it. But that's not, that is kind of, hold on here. Where is, okay. What we're going to do is, I want to skip this if that's okay. Let me go back here, if I can. There are a variety, if I go back to the very beginning here, and we talked about how there was a covalent catalysis, a general acid-base catalysis, a metal ion catalysis. What I'm going to do now for the next few slides, just to get everybody oriented, is I'm going to talk about these three things in kind of a generalized point of view. After that, I will give you a specific about a serine protease. So let's go ahead and skip ahead now. We're now moving back to the slide where we talked about the covalent catalysis. Now we're going to be looking at general acid-base catalysis. So if you want to connect this to that outline that we saw near the beginning of our lecture today. Catalysis is when a proton is transferred through the transition state. A specific acid catalysis involves a hydrogen hydroxide that diffuses into the catalytic center. Okay. A general acid-base catalysis involves acids and bases other than hydrogen and hydroxide. Now, what that means is, probably the general acid-base catalysis means that something in the active site provides a proton or a hydroxide in the part of this catalysis. That's what the general means. The specific means, oddly enough, it seems counterintuitive. Specific means the hydroxide or hydrogen ion comes in from the solvent. Okay. So we're going to take a look at how to differentiate between the two. If you see here, all right, in specific acid-base catalysis, The hydroxy or hydrogen ion, hydroxide ion concentration affects the reaction rate. K observed is independent, but the buffers, which accept or donate hydrogen ions, have no effect. In other words, here you've got A is where the proton or the neutron, a proton, the hydroxide, is diffusing in from the outside. And so, in this case, it must be the hydroxide being diffusing in from the outside because the rate is greater with the basic buffer. The rate is greater with the basic buffer. But notice, all that matters here is the relative pH of the environment, not the concentration of the buffer itself. So just how many hydroxides are in the environment in terms of the pH tell us what the rate is going to be. It's counterintuitive, okay? Because when you look at pH 6, what's the hydrogen ion concentration in pH 6? Do you know? It's 1 times 10 to the minus 6 molar. Is that right? Hello? Yes, indeed. Well, how can you have it? All right, so the concentration of hydrogen ion here, let's call this 1 times 10 to the minus 6 molar. And here you have the concentration of the buffer. And this is 0.01 molar, 0.1 molar, 1 molar. This is logarithmic, wow. 10 molar. So the buffer concentration is 0.1, 1, 1, and 10. That's the buffer concentration. The pH is always at 6. This is pH of equal to 6. Well, how can I have the buffer concentration keep going up, but the pH always being the same pH? How does that work? How does that make any sense? This has a greater... Which of these has the greater ability to absorb acid or base and not change the pH? Which one has the greater? Is it 0.1, 0.01 has a greater capacity or 10 has a greater capacity? 10. Okay. 10. Why? Here's the dirty little secret about buffers and buffer concentration. Notice, if it's a pH 6, no matter what the concentration of the buffer, the concentration of the hydrogen ion always has to be the same. What we're changing here is the concentration of the conjugate base and the undissociated acid. That's what's changing in this buffer concentration. I'm moving from a very dilute A and A minus and HA to a very concentrated A minus and HA, but all the time I'm changing the concentration of the A minus and the HA, am I changing the concentration of the hydrogen ion? Apparently what? Apparently not. Okay. So I can change the buffer concentration and not change the pH. So notice I'm changing the buffer concentration here. All right. Changing the buffer concentration here, but not changing the rate because the actual concentration of the hydrogen ion and the hydroxide ion is not changing. What's going on down here, though? This is the general acid-base catalysis, where the ionizable buffer may donate or accept a proton in transition state. Okay, is observed on that. In other words, what's happening here is that notice I said in the general acid-base concentration, the active site in the enzyme has a hydrogen ion or hydroxide ion. It actually donates to this process. So having that situation would allow, that means that the buffer concentration on the outside affects how well that can diffuse in or out or be a part of the transition state. And so the buffer concentration does make a difference there. It's a strange idea. Please read about it in your text. We don't have time to go over it anymore. But ponder this and see if it makes any sense to you. All right. Catalysis of para-nitrophenylacetate hydrolysis by imidazole, an example of general acid-base catalyst. That means when you get the hydrogen ion or hydroxide ions occurs from within the molecule. So here you have the actual reaction where there's a hydrolysis and that ester bond is broken. Here you have this imidazole structure. That's a part of the active site. It actually creates its acid base with water being in the active site. So that imidazole is not being diffused in from the outside, but it's present in the active site. That's why it's called general. All right? Does that make sense? The imidazole that initiates the acid base creation is within the site. That's why they call it general. And then you get this process where the hydroxide's formed and blah, blah, blah. And that hydrogen ion then goes back and is restored. So that is one day. You can tell by this business, this is an example of a general acid base in which the imidazole, which is part of the active site, probably histidine actually, is there. Low barrier hydrogen bonds. This is something this particular book emphasizes. I'm not really sure I understand it completely or I care about it much, so we're just going to skip that. And here is this is where the metal ion comes in. This is where the metal ion, so like this, these positive charges that come from metal ions are part of this process, and they can donate or accept electrons and therefore increase the rate because they can act as an electrophile. Yes? Two slides? Okay. Was there something I missed? I went too fast? Low barrier hydrogen bonds. What that means is they reduce the strength of the hydrogen bonds. That's what that means. You reduce the strength of the hydrogen bonds. What? In yours? There's only three things? Okay, we're all done? All right. All right. Again, you can use metal catalyst. Metal ion is a catalyst either for electrophile or nucleophile depending on the charge. All right. What can we learn from typical enzyme mechanisms? Is there anything to fill in here? No. Well, I'm giving you good. Serine proteases and the phosphatidic proteases are. A serine protease means this. A serine is a part of the active site. That's what a serine protease means. A serine is part of the active site. Serine is a part of the active site. It doesn't mean it's just acting on serines. It means within the enzyme, the catalytic mechanism involves a serine. In this case, it must involve an aspartic acid. All right. Now, what are some important serine proteases? The most common, of course, is trypsin, chymotrypsin elastase. Those are all digestive enzymes. Thrombin, of course, is involved in the blood clot cascade. Plasmin is also a part of the blood clotting cascade. Either it's breakdown or build up. All involved with serine and catalysis, that's the name serine, is a part of a catalytic triad composed of serine, histidine, and aspartic acid. Serine proteases are homologous. What that means is they kind of have the same sequence. They kind of have the same sequence, but not exactly. That's why they say the crucial residues are different. What three crucial residues are different? Which ones do you think they're talking about when they say crucial residues are different? What three are they talking about? When I say residue, what am I actually talking about? So what three amino acids am I talking about? Serine, histidine, and aspartic acid. Enzymologists agree to number them, as always, histidine 57, aspartate 102, and serine 195. In other words, no matter where they are, they're actually labeled that, oddly enough. So here is chymotrypsin, trypsin, elastase. There's nothing much here to realize except you see histidine, aspartic, and serine are hydrolyzed, outlined. And notice they kind of occur about in the same position for each of these. But chymotrypsin, trypsin, and elastase have completely different targets for where they break. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. We'll see you on Monday. And we're going to do some enzyme activity, enzyme calculations on Monday. Bring a calculator, please.